Thank you, Jonga, and blessing. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Thursday, January 22nd, 2015. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Chris Gande.
And I'm Sithandekile Mhlanga.
Here are our top stories this evening.
Opposition leader and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai today appealed to the MDC-led Harare City Council to prioritize unplanned settlements like Hopley in the provision of infrastructure and sanitation to prevent outbreaks of diseases.
There is a lot of challenge to our city council to make sure that we deal with these unplanned settlements, or they are reorganized in such a way they are also brought within the main system.
Some ZANU-PF youths protested today at the Harare International Airport calling for the expulsion of former Secretary for Administration Didmus Mdasa from the party as President Robert Mugabe arrived back home from a month-long holiday in Asia.
As youth league, you are represented against Mdasa. To go in public and tarnish the image of the party, you want to tell our leaders to expel Mdasa.
And the wait is over for candidates who sat for A-level examinations last year under the Zimbabwe School Examination Council. Stay tuned for more.
Opposition leader and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai today appealed to the MDC-led Harare City Council to prioritize unplanned settlements like Hopley in the provision of infrastructure and sanitation to prevent outbreaks of diseases. Ivan Chifera has more details from Harare.
Addressing Hopley residents in Harare South this afternoon, Tsvangirai said it was disturbing that 10 years after it was set up, the settlement does not have proper houses, water and sanitation facilities, leaving residents exposed to waterborne diseases. He said council must regularize the settlement and provide water and sanitation to all unplanned settlements sprouting around the city.
There is a lot of challenge to our city council to make sure that we deal with these unplanned settlements, or they are reorganized in such a way they are also brought within the main system. Otherwise, we'll continue to sit on a very serious plan board.
Residents told the former Prime Minister they were building structures haphazardly and were drinking unprotected water from wells while council did not provide any service. Officials at the local clinic, which serves about 120,000 residents, said waterborne diseases like diarrhea are rampant in the area. Harare Mayor Bernard Manyenyeni, who accompanied Tsvangirai, said council is committed to solve the residents' problems but is hamstrung by the shortage of resources.
We were resource constrained, but there are also technical challenges around the sewer arrangement, the gravity, and it's on an elevated platform for it to actually feed in directly against gradient. So there's a technical challenge around that, something that can be overcome, but not immediately.
He added the problem of unplanned settlements was as a result of government's failure to adhere to proper urban planning procedures. Hopley and other unplanned settlements like Caledonia were created to accommodate thousands of Harare residents whose houses were destroyed during Operation Murambatswina or Operation Remove Field in 2005. Residents were told not to build proper structures as government said their settlements were temporary. But 10 years on, the government has not provided permanent homes to the victims. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Some ZANU-PF youths staged a peaceful demonstration today at the Harare International Airport calling for the expulsion of former Secretary for Administration Didmus Mdasa as President Robert Mugabe arrived back home from a month-long holiday in Asia. Harare ZANU-PF Youth League Chairman Godwin Gomwe tells Studio 7 the youths sang revolutionary songs and carried placards denouncing Mdasa for writing a document calling for the nullification of the results of 2014 ZANU-PF Elective Congress. Gomwe says the president, who was welcomed at the airport by Zimbabwe's recently appointed Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa and Phelekezela Mphoko and top state officials, expressed dismay over Mdasa's moves to engage lawyers to declare the ZANU-PF Congress as unconstitutional.
Mutasa, former Vice President Joyce Mujuru and several other senior party officials were sidelined in the run-up to the ZANU-PF Congress last December with claims that they wanted to topple President Mugabe using unconstitutional ways. They have all denied any wrongdoing, claiming that they were victims of machinations by another faction of the party led by Mnangagwa to clandestinely take control of the party. Gomwe tells Studio 7's Gibbs Dube they want the president and his party's Politburo to take stern measures against Mutasa, who still maintains that he is the ZANU-PF secretary for administration.
As usually, you are represented against Mutasa to go in public and tarnish the image of the party. And it seems that if Mutasa is not in ZANU-PF, then ZANU-PF is dead. So I wanted to show him that you are not ZANU-PF and ZANU-PF is alive, even though you are out.
So now, do you think that perhaps the president will talk to Mr. Mutasa about your demonstration?
No, Mutasa is nothing. Our president wanted to talk to Mutasa. Mutasa is now a cell member. His utterances in public, it shows immaturity. Even though I'm still the secretary for administration of the party, now is Comrade Ignatius Chombo, not Mutasa. If you want to be a secretary of another party, maybe.
So now, after protesting today, what are you going to do next?
There's nothing we can do. We are waiting for the Politburo to sit. As Youth League, we want to tell our leaders at Politburo, which is headed by our president, secretary of the party, to expel Mutasa.
That was Harare ZANU-PF Youth League Chairman Godwin Gomwe speaking with Studio 7 from Harare. Mutasa was not available for comment as his mobile phone was not reachable.
ZANU-PF Central Committee member Joseph Chuma says the youths have a right to stage such peaceful protests against any ZANU-PF supporter.
The youths are the vanguard of the party. So if the youth see something amiss or something wrong that is being done within the party, it's within their right, it's within their obligation, actually, to carry out any such demonstration, which will actually sort of concretize the leadership to take action accordingly. The youths are the ones that normally must contribute more towards the welfare of the church, be it evangelism, be it the welfare of the pastors, be it the welfare of the orphans, the widows, and such people like that. So even in our organization, our youth are the vanguard of the party. They are the future of the party. If they think that there's something wrong within the party, it's within their right again now, show that they're not happy with that kind of thing.
What is going to happen next?
Those are demonstrations to show the unhappiness of the youth towards one of our former leaders. So what is going to happen? Everything has been done. The province itself has already sat down through the provincial coordinating committee. They came up with their recommendations and they forwarded them to Politburo. So when Politburo sits, Politburo will deliberate on that. Then we are going to all be guided accordingly from what Politburo comes up with.
That was ZANU-PF Central Committee member Joseph Chuma speaking with Studio 7 from Bulawayo.
And a political analyst Nkululeko Sibanda of Huddersfield University in London says the demonstrations are an indication that factionalism is still rife in ZANU-PF and may devastate the party.
I think that what this tells us is that, in effect, President Mugabe no longer has as much control of the party as we thought he did. Because when you look at these demonstrations, they would tell you politically that he is not, in effect, in complete control of everything that's happening. In fact, it seems to me as though President Mugabe is behind the events, is following the events and reacting to events, whereas for a strong man like him and for a party that has been led by one person for a very long time, that would be a very dangerous and certainly precarious position.
So now, looking at what is happening, the youths are actually calling for the expulsion of Mr. Mutasa. So what do you think is going to happen?
Pushing President Mugabe's hand to the extent that he has to expel people and necessarily setting that precedent at this moment is going to be very dangerous, because there is no indication at all that if the expulsion starts with Mutasa, it will end there. I think that would then be a precedent for him to continue doing the purging, forced to do so by certain members of his party.
That was political analyst Nkululeko Sibanda of Huddersfield University speaking with Studio 7 on the line from Britain.
The wait is over for candidates who sat for A-level exams last year, and 62.61% of them reserve the right to celebrate after passing two or more subjects with an E grade or better. The Zimbabwe School Examination Council says today, out of 30,614 examinees, 25,291 had passed. This slightly increased the ZIMSEC A-level pass rate from 81,058 in 2013 to 82.61% last year. ZIMSEC Director Isao Nandara said in a statement that of the 7,324 private candidates who sat for the same exam, 4,217 of them had passed. Reporter Ntungameli Nkomo reached the educationist Sifiso Ndlovu, an official with the Zimbabwe Teachers Association, for his perspective.
First and foremost, we must congratulate the teachers who have made the children succeed. But let us also remember that when we look at the pass rate, it is also important to bring about the quality of the results, which is what Zimta has been campaigning for in 2014 and will continue to campaign in 2015 and beyond in terms of education for all. The quality of education must be assessed. So the quality of grades is what we now must focus on. And this is the challenge that we face as a country now. Otherwise, in terms of the 82%, it is not a very bad result. It's quite a good result.
Can you explain further, Mr. Ndlovu, on the aspect of quality?
Yes, the issue of quality would mean there is a difference between an A and an E. While they are both passes, but there is a difference. Admirably, we would have loved all our students to be above the D mark or C and above. That would have been the best in terms of assessing quality. That is what I'm trying to bring about in terms of quality.
That was educationist and ZIMTA official Sifiso Ndlovu.
You are listening to Studio 7 for Zimbabwe from the Voice of America in Washington.
Studio 7 can be found on the 4930, 5930 and 15455 kilohertz shortwave frequencies. We also broadcast on 909 medium wave or AM frequency.
Coming up,
teen pregnancies, a big problem in the country.
But first, a look at regional and international news.
Officials in the U.S. northeastern state of New Jersey have released a video of the shooting death of an unarmed black man at the hands of two police officers during a traffic stop. The death of 36-year-old Jeremy Reid in the town of Bridgetown on December 30, which was captured by a video camera mounted in the officer's car, occurred just moments after the car Reid was riding in was pulled over by officers Days and Roger Wally. The officers pulled their guns on Reid and the driver after a gun was spotted in the car. He was shot after he got out of the car with his hands raised in the air, despite being ordered by the officers to remain in the car.
The number of new Ebola cases in West Africa dropped sharply last week, raising hopes the regional epidemic is on the wane. The World Health Organization says 145 new Ebola cases were reported in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in the week ending January 18th.
And the United States and Cuba are holding a second day of talks in Havana aimed at restoring diplomatic relations after more than 50 years. The reopening of U.S. and Cuban embassies in the two nations' capitals will be the main focus of the final day of high-level negotiations between the Cold War-era enemies. Washington will call on Cuba to lift restrictions on the number of U.S. diplomats sent to the island, as well as travel restrictions on them during their stay.
You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington, D.C.
The new International Labour Organization report on the world employment and social outlook for 2014 is now available after being released into the public domain this week. The employment situation has not improved much in sub-Saharan Africa, despite better economic growth performance. And in North Africa, the employment outlook has deteriorated, says the ILO in its new report, which also highlights how unemployment, income inequality, and social unrest will continue to affect the African region in the coming years, despite better economic growth performance. Labour experts in Zimbabwe say the report, which pegs Zimbabwe's unemployment rate at 5% and ranks it better than countries such as Zambia, Mozambique, and Uganda, is misleading as it takes millions of informal traders in the country as being gainfully employed.
The report entitled The World of Work Report 2014 Developing with the Jobs ranks Zimbabwe as a lower middle income country with the likes of Morocco, Ghana, Pakistan, while Zambia, Mozambique and Uganda, among 49 others, are ranked as least developed countries. Labour organizations and other peg unemployment in Zimbabwe at more than 80%. For perspective, reporter Tatenda Gumbo spoke with Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe economist Prosper Chitambara and Resources Exploitation Watch head Tafadzwa Musarara. Musarara applauds the ILO report, saying it reflects the situation on the ground.
We are happy that the figures have come, and also if you look closely, the figures have shown that since 2006 up to now, there has been a decline in unemployment, which ultimately, conversely, means that there has been an increase in employment creation in Zimbabwe.
Mr. Chitambara, what's your take, as often as Zimbabwe is reported to have an unemployment rate of between 80 and 90%, but here we're seeing that it's 5.42%.
We need to look at these figures in the light of, number one, the wrenching structural changes that have actually taken place in our economy vis-a-vis the issues of deindustrialization. Many companies have been closing and many workers have been losing their jobs. So there's been massive deindustrialization in the formal economy, and also that has resulted in the informalization of the economy. So what it means is that people that have lost their jobs in the formal economy are now subsisting in the informal sector. So basically these figures, what they do is to hide the high levels of underemployment within the Zimbabwean economy. There's again this disconnect between these low unemployment rates and also low government revenues, and also on the other hand, high poverty levels.
Mr. Msarara, as Mr. Chitambara is pointing out, is it safe to look at this figure and then not acknowledge what he's saying is the discontent between the low unemployment rates but also the issue of high poverty levels in Zimbabwe, that even though people are making money in the informal sector, they are far below the PDL?
Absolutely correct. You appreciate that even those countries with better revenue generation, they build on that on the basis of international support, donor support, and others. We don't have that. You know, I think you still recall the former Minister of Finance introducing what he used to call eat what we kill. Other economies that you have seen their population having a better life than ourselves with the middle class, so you've done that on the basis, of course, of international support. If you look at Zambia, for instance, which is a sizable middle class, but more than 40% of their budget is funded by donors. Malawi, more than 60% is funded by donors. We don't have that. It's very little, if not any. Yes, it's correct to say that our population is probably not living to their expectations. They're not living the Zimbabwe dream that they want. But it's a result of those extraneous factors.
Mr. Chitambara, what about the issue of taxes, as you touched on, or government revenue? This is an issue where, of course, there's a large informal sector, but the issue is that the government isn't able to tax these informal traders.
Many of these activities are not viable. That's why most of the traders are living from hand to mouth. They don't even have a lot of money at the end of the day or at the end of the month to save. So there are a whole lot of structural issues that need to be dealt with. But at the end of the day, what we want, we don't want these guys to remain in the informal. We want these guys to graduate and go into the formal.
And I'll end here with you, Mr. Msarara. Same question. How can government change this issue? Because, of course, we can sit here and say, yes, there's a 5% unemployment rate, but government is still needing revenue.
Well, the Zuma Center document is very clear that we have to move toward enhanced local productivity. We need to reindustrialize. We need to have legal framework
that support local production, cut down on imports. We have, because of the dollarization, attracted, we opened up our windows. But in the process, we attracted mosquitoes and all the flies in, which were supposed just to open enough to allow fresh air and keep the rest out.
And that was Resources Exploitation Watch head Tafadzwa Musarara. You also heard the views of Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe economist Prosper Chitambara. Both were talking to Studio 7's Tatenda Gumbo.
The Southern African nation of Zimbabwe has long been known as a hotspot for child marriages. The United Nations say that as many as 31% of Zimbabwean girls are married before the age of 18. But two such girls say enough is enough and are challenging the government at the highest level to lift the age of consent for girls to 18. From Harare, Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA.
Loveness Manzuru and Ruvimbo Tsopodzi were just girls when they were married and gave birth for the first time. Now the pair is challenging what they say was a violation of their rights in Zimbabwe's highest court. They are seeking to raise the legal majority age for girls from 16 years to 18, the same as it is for boys. They are also seeking the annulment of existing child marriages, a change that could affect countless girls and their families. Their lawyer, former Minister Tendai Biti, argued before the Constitutional Court that 18 years is the threshold to ensure that potential brides are making their own decisions.
There is a problem in Zimbabwe of early marriages. One in three Zimbabwean women is married below the age of 18. The thing is, most of these girls who come from poor backgrounds. So you've got a situation of a child carrying a child, educational attainments are curtailed, empowerment opportunities are curtailed, so it then becomes a continuous cycle of poverty.
Beat argued in court that the new constitution specifies 18 as the legal age to decide to have a family. He also says condoning marriage at a younger age violates Article 56 of the Constitution, which guarantees equal protection under the law. Emily Napambo of the development organization Plan International says child marriage fails to protect the rights of children and needs to end.
We have very high prevalence rates of child marriages, second from South Asia. So as a region, we are at 37%. But within that region, we have hotspots, which are countries with even much higher prevalence rates above 37%. For example, in Mozambique, in Malawi, in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, for every 100 girls, 50 of them at least get married by the time they're 18 years old.
Those who oppose child marriage say it is often provoked by poverty, lack of knowledge, and long-standing cultural beliefs. But they note that these marriages kick off a string of human rights violations by preventing girls from getting further education, which in turn can diminish their chances of getting good work and good health care. And Zimbabwean authorities say the consequences can be deadly. The incidence of two young mothers, they say, contributes to the nation's high rates of child and maternal mortality. Beatrice Savage heads Real Opportunities for Transformation Supporters, a group that lobbies for gender rights and is helping the two plaintiffs in the case.
So it's young people that have gone through child marriage and have really felt the consequences of marrying early, who are, you know, standing up to say it doesn't have to happen to any other child. So it's part of our ongoing campaign on ending child marriages that we're doing in Zimbabwe. We have seen a lot of cases of child marriages in different provinces where we're going and conducting community dialogues with chiefs. The communities, even the local authorities and chiefs, really rallying behind the campaign. And so that local effort that's being done by the chiefs and local authorities has to be complemented by efforts at a national level to ensure that there's that harmony between laws and what's happening on the ground.
It is not clear when the Constitutional Court will issue a ruling in this case. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
A somber atmosphere engulfed Malindi and Malila villages in Cholocho, Matabeleland North this morning when about 9 bodies of Zimbabweans who died in a road accident in Botswana almost 2 weeks ago were buried in the area. Amidst reports that one more accident victim has succumbed to injuries at Mahalapie Hospital in the neighboring country. Government officials and relatives of the deceased received the bodies at Plumtree Border Post overnight. The deceased, who are aged between 24 and 35, are Manson Ncube, Davison Sbanda, Eunice Moyo, Sharon Moyo, Liston Mlilo, Nozitelo Sbanda, Langelihle Phiri, Bonita Ncube, and Methuseli Sbanda.
The other two are siblings, 7-year-old Ndotana Kombo and 8-year-old Nokubonga Kombo from Machinge area in Bilingoma, Bulilima, Matabeleland South. The children's mother and 6 other passengers survived the accident, which occurred when a South African-bound truck they were traveling in hit a donkey and rammed into a tree, killing 11 people on the spot. Cholocho District Administrator Nosisi Dube reportedly said some of the victims did not have passports, which delayed the repatriation of the bodies from Mahalapai Mortuary Hospital in Botswana. Chief Gambo Sithole of Cholocho, who was part of the team which assisted in the repatriation and attended one of the burials this morning, says the government assisted the families with burial expenses.
Coming up next, here is an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than a year after the largest Ebola epidemic ever recorded began in a remote part of Guinea, and 5 months after it was recognized as a public health emergency of international concern, there is still much to be done to stop the outbreak, a top American health official said after returning from the 3 most affected nations. Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, returned to the U.S. from West Africa on December 21st, where he spoke with patients and doctors, met with many of the CDC's 170 staff members in the region, and met with the presidents, health ministers, and Ebola coordinators in each country. He described the situation as both inspiring and sobering. It is inspiring to see how much better the response has become in the past 2 months, how much international commitment there is, and, most importantly, how hard people from each of the 3 countries are working to stop Ebola, Dr. Frieden said. But it is sobering that Ebola continues to spread rapidly in Sierra Leone, and that in parts of Monrovia and Conakry, Ebola is spreading unabated. Improvements in contact tracing are urgently needed. At a briefing held to discuss the results of his trip to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, Dr. Frieden described progress in some areas, but continued growth in Ebola cases in others. In Liberia, the outbreak has slowed dramatically, and at the moment, the country has the upper hand against the virus, in part due to improvements in access to Ebola treatment units and community care centers, safe burials, and community engagement, he said. But the outbreak continues to surge in Sierra Leone, and there has been a troubling spread in Guinea's capital city. We've got a long way to go, and this is no time to relax our grip on the response. The recent approval of $1.2 billion to strengthen international response and preparedness is crucial to stopping Ebola and improving global capacity to prevent, detect, and quickly respond to health threats like Ebola in the future. As the United States and its partners continue to mobilize against the disease, we are also considering how to ensure that our immediate response measures contribute to long-term capacity to protect against infectious disease threats.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And now to recap today's top stories.
And before we recap, we'd like to inform the listeners that today on our live talk, it's the Women's Roundtable, and they'll be talking about how to start and run a business.
To join the discussion, text us at 001202-465-0318 so we can call you back from our studios.
That's it for tonight. My name is Chris Gande. Good night, Zimbabwe.
And I'm Stanley Gilemhlanga, also wishing you a pleasant evening and a very good night.